Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Hello, everyone. Karen Conti here, getting ready for a nice 2 hour show. We're going to be talking about some of the legal topics of the week, but just general topics as well. We're going to talk to an expert later in the show about workplace violence. And this guy is a guy who counsels churches, schools, and workplaces on how to prevent, how to recognize people who might be violent in the workplace, how to prevent it, and how to keep employees safe. He's real good. He's real interesting. He's had a lot of good experience. And obviously, with the Aurora shooting very close to home, coming on the tail of the Northern Illinois shooting so many years ago on the 14th, it was the February 15th, just brought back a lot of bad memories from the Northern shooting, as well as the Parkland shooting, of course, from last year. So we look forward to that. And at 8 o'clock, I will be taking your calls on any legal topic you might have. I'm a practicing lawyer. I've been practicing for 33 years. And if you have a question about something that's near and dear to your heart or a friend of yours, give us a call here, whether it's family law or traffic or criminal, or if there's something that you saw in the news that you'd like to ask me about, the Jason Van Dyke prison beating. We have the El Chapo conviction. We have a national emergency going on and litigation that is being pursued. So if you have any questions about those things, I can weigh in. Try not to get too opinionated, but I can talk about the legalities of these things and maybe explain something if you don't understand it. One thing I wanted to announce is I'm going to be a speaker. International Women's Day is coming up, and on March 7th, I'm going to be part of a panel. Interesting, we're talking about Me Too movement, and not really the typical Me Too conversation, because we've had all those conversations, and I think, frankly, there's not much more that we can say about Me Too. But what is interesting is in the workplace, there is a backlash from Me Too. There are men who do not want to work with women. There are men who are afraid of traveling with a woman, afraid of going to lunch with a woman, afraid of even maybe having a meeting in the same office alone with a woman because they're afraid of being accused of some sort of sexual harassment. Whether that's justified or not, it's causing a huge problem in the workplace. And we have a panel discussion for breakfast on March 7th. It's at Prime and Provisions. It's at 7:30 in the morning, so you'll be out of there before your workday if you're working in the loop. And if you want more information on it, it's Private Vista is the organization that's putting it on. Or you can always email me and I can send you the link. It's free. Anyway, I didn't know if I said that, but that's March 7th. In the morning, 7:30 in the morning, Prime and Provisions, that's on 222 North LaSalle. At 7:30 in the morning, free breakfast, and it should be very interesting. We have an interesting panel, and I'll be lending my opinion to the whole mix. But let's go to our first guest, one of my favorite people in all of Chicago, probably the most well-known and longest-working news personalities in Chicago and maybe even the country. Welcome, Walter Jacobson. How are you?
Oh, I am just fine now that I'm here with you, Casey, as I know you. And you know what? I probably am. I didn't think about this, but I'm 81. I probably am the oldest regular guy or guy regularly on the, or woman for sure, regularly on the air here in Chicago.
Well, and you but have you, been for what, 56 years? About
56 years.
56
yeah.
years. Yeah. That's just amazing.
And you know what? You don't get credit these days for being older and more experienced because, as you know, our business now is very interested in youth and beauty and less experience. And we can talk about that and tell you why.
No, that's so true. And, you know, I have to say this because I do commentary on Fox Local, and the women and the men are very lovely, you know, and they're very smart. It's not that they're not well-educated or intelligent. It's just that the people in your day really went out and got the news stories, and you just don't see people reporting. You know, they might be standing outside on, you know, watching the falling ice and saying, hey, the ice is falling, but they're not going out and getting a story and investigating it and interviewing people and taking notes and coming up with a story. I mean, is that fair to say?
Absolutely fair to say. And it's shameful. It's too bad. It's sad. And there are reasons for it, though. One of the reasons, the most prominent reason, perhaps, is that it's very expensive to have enough people to get out on the street, especially on television, if you need camera crews, electricians, light people, and all of that. And the station managers don't want to and cannot really honestly afford to keep up with the expenses of covering news. That's the legitimate reason, if there is such a thing, because I doubt that too, because, you know, there's no such thing as having a news operation and it being legitimate to not do news, which is what's going on, which is too bad. But it's also because there's just not enough time on the air, or at least not enough time is devoted to reporting and getting feedback on stories that are meaningful to people, stories that affect our lives. Budgets in Springfield, for example, or in Washington, those are harder to cover. They take a little more time, and the trend these days, increasingly, sadly, is fast. You got a minute to talk about J.B. Pritzker's new budget. A minute. You know, just imagine that. And the management says, well, that's what we got to do. Why? I've asked year in and year out. Because the normal attention span is short and getting shorter, and people won't stay to listen.
I feel like people want to be entertained first and informed second, when maybe 25 years ago, I felt like they wanted to be more informed first. And, you know, even with the interesting amount of information available on the internet, I mean, you know, you and I, you know, when we wanted to get information when we were kids, we had to walk to the library and go to the card catalog and look it up and find the book or the outdated Encyclopedia Britannica. Now you can Google anything and find information. Whether it's accurate or not is another story. But I just don't feel like people are very interested in being informed on some of the issues that you're talking about, the issues that really do matter, the budgets. And how about the wars that are going on? I don't even see any reporting on that. We seem like we're more interested in collusion and politics. And those are important issues, too. Don't get me wrong. But we seem like it's a one-issue television network in these days.
Very keen observation. Question is, why?
Yeah, why
are people losing? Why have they lost? Many people lost interest in the specifics of news that matters. I don't know whether it's because they don't hear it or because they know what they're going to get and it's going to be entertaining and they won't stay if it's not going to be that. And then it's up to management of the television and radio stations and the newspapers to give them what they want. Give them what they want.
And you know what, I believe that if you give them information, and this is what I try to do on my show, at least a little bit for 2 hours, is to give them information, but make it informative, but fun and entertaining, so that you can walk away from my show and learn something, and maybe tell your friend, "Hey, did you know this?" And that's my goal. Obviously, I want people to listen, and I don't want to be boring, and I don't want to give them facts that put them to sleep. But I think you can do both.
Well, you have a high standard. I wonder how typical that is across the spectrum of radio and television. I don't think it's very typical. If you're doing that much, and sorry to say, because I've known you for so long, I don't listen often to the radio. I don't even have a radio except in my car, and I don't drive very far. But it's changed, and you've made that observation.
We've
got to find out how to change it back.
Let's continue this conversation. If you have a comment for Walter Jacobson, 981-7200-312-981-7200, or text to that number. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. To Walter Jacobson, who's been in the business of television and radio and media and newspapers for 56 years. Walter, when you were doing the news and you were on CBS and you were on Fox and you made the rounds, there was the idea that you had to be neutral, that you could not have your opinions while you were reporting the news. You could not give your opinions. But when you did your perspective, you actually put on a different kind of suit of clothes and you went to a different part of the newsroom and you gave your opinion because it was that important for you to be neutral. Why don't we have that anymore? Why do we have to go from station to station to hear the totally different opinions?
You know, the opinions are okay being expressed if they would be identified as opinions. The problem with the media today is, particularly cable television, that the producers of it and the anchors on it want everybody that's listening to believe that they're getting the news. So they all act like it's news, but then, and it is, you know, there is news, but the news is then quickly addended by opinion. And maybe, Karen, maybe people are just getting sick and tired of hearing so much opinion. Maybe people, this would be wonderful, maybe take out people like me in your commentaries, but it would give a chance for the media to identify. Look at the reason Donald Trump is so unhappy with CNN, and the reason I've become so unhappy with CNN, which was my history in the media business, my hero in the history of the media business, is because CNN every night for 2 hours, and I watch an awful lot of this stuff because I want to stay up on what's happening. CNN for 2 hours will have a panel of guests maintain its objectivity by saying, well, here's John Jones, here's Susie Smith, but they don't have the different opinions that we want to hear. The media, as you've suggested, cable television has a very firm agenda right now, and it is to get rid of Donald Trump. It's like Fox News has a very serious agenda, Hannity and company, to keep Fox News in position that it is, which is twice at least the audience that CNN and MSNBC have combined. But they're kidding us, and maybe people are catching on to that. I you know, when you listen to them talk, the anchors on cable news, especially CNN, and tell us how objective they're being and how much news they're covering. And then when they introduce a guest, a series of guests, and they're all of exactly the same opinion, which conforms to the opinion of the more progressive or liberal CNN. Fox does the same thing on the other end.
Right. I mean, I even hate to watch my own opinion. Okay, I have a real strong opinion about what goes on, and I don't even like watching the station that gives me my opinion back. I don't need to have my opinion given back to me. I'd like to know more facts. Even the news stories that they choose show a bias. And the thing that I really hate the most is when the anchors sit there and roll their eyes and smile or look sarcastic. And it's like, what happened to the day of someone just giving you the facts? And again, having opinion people on is good, but having both sides, having, you know, even I was on the Bill O'Reilly show, and I'm not a big fan of him, but at least he will put on both sides. He may not let one side talk as much, but I was able to get out my point, and he let the other side get out his point. And I think that makes for great television, and that makes for you to be able to make your own opinion. And I don't know why people don't want to have their own opinion.
Maybe that's part of why Bill O'Reilly was so successful, the most successful television talk show host in the history of the business.
Smart guy, no question about that.
He knew what to do, and he had that streak in him that said, let's be a little fair about this. I wonder if part of the reason you say you hate to hear yourself giving an opinion is that this is what I experienced some time ago, the fear of management telling you that it's being approached too negatively by the listening audience and wants you to conform to a more popular point of view.
Well, sure, right? And maybe back in the day they didn't do that. But I even feel like when I give my legal opinion, I try to make myself take out the political part of that. You know, I have an opinion. Is someone going to go to jail? Do I think someone should go to jail? But as far as politics, I try to keep it out because people will, I mean, the hate mail, the horrible text that I get I had a topic on the other day, and I did not say Donald Trump's name the entire time, and people were texting me saying, how dare you talk about our president that way? I didn't say his name, and neither did my guest. And so people are so sensitive and so ready to jump on others, and I think it's affecting the whole society. I think it's affecting social media. I think it's affecting people in school. Everyone's overly sensitive, and it's like a minefield out there.
So maybe the guilt belongs to the polarization of our political world right now. People are so into each other's weaknesses and flaws and making such a fuss about each other that it's got to be opinionated. It's got to be identified as opinion, and that's not good.
Polarized.
When I was doing those Walter's Perspectives on television for all those years, and Bill Curtis and I were anchoring the news, delivering the news as news, and when it was time for my perspective, I would get up from the news set, from the desks in the newsroom, and go to another corner of the newsroom where my seat was with a typewriter, and I would take off my jacket.
I remember that you have your suspenders on.
Yes, and then underneath my face on television, it always said Walter's Perspective. So maybe that's why there wasn't so much complaining about it back then as there is now. Nobody identifies himself or herself as a perspective or opinion giver.
We're talking to Walter Jacobson on the Karen Conti Show. I want to talk about some of your career highlights, and one of them, we kind of intersected a little bit. Actually, you and I, Walter, have done some interesting things together, because there are times when I would get clients who needed some publicity for their issue, and that was the only way something was going to get done one way or the other. So we had a few of those together where I would take the legal part of it, and you would obviously take the media part of it.
Or you'd call me up and say, listen, I've got a good story for you that kind of fits your idea of what a commentary or perspective.
There was a great one that I remember.
Wrigley Field,
yes. That was an interesting case. That was when the Dodgers went up into the stands. One of the fans stole a hat from Chad Kruder, who was the catcher for the Dodgers at the time. And the Dodgers all went up into the stands. I think there were like 18 of them or so. And they went up and they were fighting with the fans, and it made national news. And I had I represented one of the guys who was punched by the Dodgers player. And so I had a lawsuit. And we talked about that. And we talked about why are the players in the stands, and are the fans at fault, and those kind of things. That was that you're right about that. I almost forgot that one.
Oh, which one did you have in mind?
I had one that was, you probably don't even remember. It was Halloween. There was a woman who went and she used her Social Security check to pay for like animals that were homeless. And she took these cats from underneath a porch, and she tried to nurse them back to health, and she spent like $200 of her Social Security money. And she was arrested for stealing the cats, because she went knocking on doors to find out if they belonged to anyone, and they were out. There was a litter out there, and she was arrested. And you did a segment, a perspective saying, doesn't the Chicago police have something better to do? And had a picture of her as a cat burglar, and it was hysterical. And then they dropped the charges. Do you remember that?
Sure, of course I remember that. I hear about that and others like it all the time. People who say, you really hurt me, and I say, oh my God, I'm sorry. What did I say that hurt you? And then I get a story like that, except in this case, I was helping the person who
we did.
And do you think that had anything to do with robbing the case?
Yes, absolutely. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. We'll be back in a minute.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grave.
Welcome back. We're talking to Walter Jacobson about the news and media and his career in journalism. I had a question, and I'm not going to read it exactly the way the listener wrote it, but wanted to know how it was to work with Bill Curtis.
Oh, that's an easy question to answer.
And was he a little stuffy? I'm going to kind of soften what the texter said.
Maybe he looked a little, compared to me, he seemed a little stuffy. But Bill Curtis was anything but stuffy. He is so smart. And it's going to sound like I'm just saying this because I've worked with him for so long. But he's like a brother. I love him. We never really became close personal friends. We very rarely, although every now and then, go out to dinner together. But he is the most multitasked person I've ever met in my life, and he's got a real strong feeling and a tremendous ability to articulate that feeling about so many things. You know, he's a rancher, and he's on,
right.
on
he's a lawyer
on public radio, and he's a lawyer. Yeah, he does an awful lot. Did your caller use the word stuffy?
No, it was a little harsher yours? Than that. but I do think he has, you know, especially compared to you, Walter, you were kind of like the wild thing, and
right.
he was kind of the proper guy with
right.
with his tie on straight.
And that combination worked.
It did.
I was Peck's bad boy, and he was the disciplinarian father. The whole thing is, I was 4 years older than he was. I am still 4 years older than him.
Walter, I want to talk about an interview that was one of your career highlights. I think you refer to it as one of your career highlights, and involved a mutual acquaintance of ours, a serial killer, John Wayne Gacy.
Right.
Can you remind mm-hmm. the listeners what happened with that interview? And we have to flash back quite a long way, because this was, you know, he was arrested back in the late 70s for crimes that he committed then and back into the 70s. Kind of set the stage and what happened and how you got the interview.
Well, I got the interview. You may know this, but I got the interview because John Wayne Gacy, of all things, was a Chicago Cubs fan.
Okay.
A committed fan, a crazy Cub fan.
And he was committed.
Right. And I was, in 1952, the Chicago Cubs bat boy. I used that. I don't know how much I want to get into all of this, but I was having trouble at Channel 2 News. And Channel 2 News, like in the conversation we've been having, was a little uncomfortable about my being so opinionated, because Channel 2 News was getting a lot of heat from the mayor and business establishment that didn't like kind of the things that I was saying and wanted to stop the commentary, the perspective on the air. In fact, they took it off the air for a while. And I said, you know, I'm not very interested in being an anchorman. I want to be the commentator. And how can I get the commentary back? And I was told, you get John Wayne Gacy in an interview, and you can have your commentary back. So I spent a year, Karen, trying to get John Wayne Gacy.
I didn't know that.
Oh, no. I called him, and they would let me talk to him only periodically, because the prison system didn't want to stir other prisoners,
right.
especially those on death row.
No, they don't like any of that.
Right. So he responded to my call one time, and he said, what do you want? And I said, I want to talk to you about whatever it is you want to talk to. I mean, getting John Wayne Gacy.
Anything.
An
you just any
right.
kind of interview.
Big scoop.
Right.
And our business is won and lost by scoop. Scoops, as you can tell what's going on now with all the reporting on Donald Trump. But I said, I want to talk to you about whatever you want to talk about. Can I come down into the, he was in, where was he, Menard?
He was in Menard, which yeah. was way south, you know, almost six or so right. hours along the Mississippi River there.
And he was on death row.
Yes.
Yeah. So he said, okay. And then I had to apply for permission from the jail system to get in there. And I was told, no, we can't have you do that. But I made the argument that how can you deprive this man of his right to speak? And that kind of swayed it for me. And I went down to Menard with a camera crew and spent an hour and a half with him in a little room with one light bulb above a desk. When we got in there early, put the cameras up, one behind me and one behind the chair he was going to sit in. And at some point, the door opened, and then he wandered with two guards, with his hands and his feet cuffed. And
it's a horrible place,
right?
And you know, I people ask me, because I represented John Gacy many, many years later in the last death row appeals. But you know, going down there, was that, how does a reporter like you feel going to? I mean, you've talked to presidents, you've talked to astronauts, you've talked to popes, you've interviewed people from all walks of life, and so now we have somebody who's killed 33 boys and buried them, most of them, under his house in the Chicago area. I mean, this is a guy who's got to be up there with one of the worst people in the world.
That's right.
Yeah. How
all,
do you,
all the more reason to want to talk to him?
Right.
I mean,
because
I'd love to have interviewed Adolf Hitler.
Because everyone says to me, even to this day, you represented Gacy. How could you, Karen? But then in the same breath, they say, but tell me what he was like.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah. So that's different. I mean, you were representing him, which made you an object of a lot of criticism because people wanted to see him put to death.
Sure.
And you know, you and I have had this discussion in the past about how can – I've even asked you that, if I remember right.
Yep.
How – why would you represent some guy who you know – he had to tell you, you were his lawyer, you knew that he did it. And I
– everyone needs a lawyer. Everyone deserves a lawyer. And he – if a lot of people – said he got what he deserved. He was executed on May 10th, 1994, without one single reprieve. So, you know,
and,
anyway.
And ironically, I wound up going to the execution. My name was
pulled
out of the hat.
Out of all names. Right. I always thought you rigged that, Walter.
No.
I thought you were around Chicago long enough to rig that one. I'm telling you, I mean, how many people were there? Not many people.
Well, there was I don't remember how many reporters, but I do remember the room where the execution was held, and I remember that the execution process didn't work, and they had to stop it and start over again. But
was that a big thing for you, the interview that you got?
Well,
with
I'll tell you this. You know, I'm often asked, in fact, I think you did here too, what I did that I liked the best. And that depends on what I've described as the best in terms of ratings, which is very important to the management and to the career of a reporter. Ratings, ratings, ratings. There was no rating that I ever got, anything that I was involved in, that produced the ratings that did.
Wow.
So that was a very successful. Other things were more important to me and more fun because I was more interested in politics than in crime, but they didn't get the kind of audience. So that made me a hero in the station, bring in that kind of an audience.
Well, everyone wants to look evil in the face, and
right.
You know, they do. They want to see the best of people, and they want to see the worst of people. And no one really had a lot of access to Gacy because he was in jail for all those years.
Right.
And that's still, they still play that interview over and over.
Well,
and
when
over
he walked
again.
Into that room, that little room, I started to feel very shaky. Not that I was in danger, but I just, my God, I am facing this horrendous, horrendous person. And when he sat down and he said, as he said to me on the telephone, "What do you want?" And I said, "You know, I just want to know what you want to tell me." And he said, "Well, of course, if everybody wants to know that. And I'm innocent, damn it. And you know it. And everybody knows that I'm innocent." And I said, "Well, no, I guess we don't know that." And then I let that sit. And then a few minutes later, I said, I don't know how it came out this way. I said, "How did you do it?
How did you kill those boys?"
Yeah, but I didn't use that language. I just said, "How did you do it?" And he asked me if I had a pencil in my pocket. And I took it out. And I said, "Yes, sure, here." And he said, and he took a piece of string out of his pocket, and he wrapped the string around the pencil and said, "This is how." And then he realized he was in a sense admitting that he had done it.
Right.
And that really turned out to be the best part of the interview.
Well, because and the lawyers must have gone crazy afterwards, because here's the serial killer who says he didn't do it, showing the world how he killed these poor young men. So I'm going to ask you one last question, because we're going to move on. But do you miss the spotlight every day that you had? And do you, when you go out, what do people say to you? What's a common phrase? Because you're still obviously recognizable everywhere you go.
Yeah, I'm surprised at to what degree that's true. But when I'm on the subway or on a bus just on the street and somebody recognizes and stops, my response is always, I haven't been on television in 10 years now, more than
wow.
that. How can you possibly remember me? Many of them would say, the voice. And I was very sure that my voice was so unattractive compared especially to Bill Curtis's stentorian tones. But they all say the same thing. And, you know, you don't know how honest that is, but we miss you. And I say, I miss being and nice talking to you. And it's happiness for both of us.
How are you feeling? You look great. You're 81 years old. You look great. I know you go up and exercise every day.
I do. I try 6 days a week. There's a running machine in the basement of our apartment building.
Well, you just keep on doing it, Walter.
I will.
Because you're going to come back on my show. And we're going to talk about some more new stuff.
Anytime you want.
The great Walter Jacobson, thank you so much for joining us. I know you walked all the way here in the snowstorm uphill.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, Walter Jacobson. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. It's Karen Conti. We had the horrible shooting in Aurora this week. I'm sure everyone knows about it, and we don't have to reiterate the facts. But suffice to say, it involved a former or a soon-to-be former employee who opened fire in the workplace. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the shootings in workplace as opposed to school shootings, which we've seen in churches and places like that. But I want to talk about the particular issues that arise when there is a workplace shooting. And I have one of the experts in the nation with me tonight, Rex Osborne. Welcome to the show. Hi, Rex.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Rex is a veteran law enforcement officer, served for 30 years, and now he's the president of More Than Talk, LLC, which consults to schools and churches and employers regarding safety issue. He regularly comments on these types of things. Thank you so much for joining us. I take it you heard
Absolutely.
About our shooting here in Aurora.
I did. I'm great friends with the former police chief and mayor of Lexington, Illinois. The minute it happened, we were on the phone with each other because it's one of those things that hits home and it gets everybody's attention.
Now, let's go right to the issue of what kind of profile, what do we have as a general profile? We don't have the whole story yet with the perpetrator here, but what is a typical employee at the workplace who gets violent? What is a typical profile?
Well, you know, I've had an opportunity to look at the guy that was the shooter there and what the profile is, and they almost match. You know, the most people who commit these crimes are male, and they're usually older than 35. And they have a history of violence, and they have a lot of other things that take place. They have low self-esteem, and many times their job is their life. And when it's interrupted, like with the termination, it throws them into a spin. A lot of them will have a fascination with firearms, or they will have, talk about violence. And all these things come to play way before the shooting happens. And that's the sad part about a lot of these, is that people after the fact go, oh, I could have picked that guy out.
Interesting. And, you know, and that's a point that you make, Rex, as a lawyer. I have handled cases of wrongful termination from both sides, from the employer employees. Mm-hmm. And I find them, they're almost like, they're almost worse than divorces in some ways, because sometimes when people are unstable in their home life or in their personal life, but they have a job that they go to every day, that sort of keeps them on the straight and narrow. And when they lose it, they're losing their pride, they're losing their money, they're losing their friendships, they're losing their self-worth. And it becomes a huge issue and a very emotional one at that. Is that, do you agree with that?
Yes. Oh, you're right on. What happens so many times is that people hire individuals. Let's check on this guy. They hire him, and if they did the background and research, they would have known that he already had some history of violence. But you want to give people a second chance.
Sure.
Or a third chance sometimes. But when you have people that are so involved in their job, and I don't know what his job was or what the circumstances to be released were, but we don't fire people like we probably should the right way. You know, this shooting did start at the termination hearing, from what I understand. It was at that meeting, and one of the victims is the human resources administrator. So you've got to figure that this wasn't just a layoff or reduction of workforce. There was a serious problem beforehand.
And we don't know what that is. I'm sure we will know that at some point.
No.
But Rex, you know, one of the things that I know, or at least I hear on the media, is that the company had like a progressive firing policy, meaning like you'd get a warning and then you'd get a second warning and a chance to, you know, do better. But as we all know, if you get that first warning, there's a good chance that you know you're going to be fired and that you're being scrutinized and that they've already decided, perhaps. I'm not saying that I know this in this case. I'm just saying that when you're being put on a performance plan and you're not making the numbers or you're not doing what you should be doing, that this guy may have known all along that he was on a track to being fired. Does that make him more or less likely to be violent? Is this something that if you want to fire someone, is it safer just to go ahead and fire that person and get them out of the workplace versus give them the extra opportunities?
You know, when we talk with HR people, we do a lot of training around the country about this. The first thing we tell them is just, first of all, avoid hiring the problem people.
Right.
And because this guy, I don't know his history, but let's just talk hypothetically with someone else. most of these folks that do this type of workplace violence have a history of frequent job changes. And when they have those, it comes right down to why did they change jobs so quickly? You'll be surprised. A lot of it's for workplace issues internally, everything from bullying to frequently blaming others. And the other part, these guys walk around asking supervisors or people they trust, going, hey, have you heard something? I heard I'm in trouble. Have you heard I'm going to lose my job? And those are all signs and signals that if the employers are doing their job, they're picking up on these and they can start addressing it before violence happens.
What are some of the, now that you're talking about the signs, symptoms, signals of someone who might be violent in the workplace? Obviously, we don't have a crystal ball. Obviously, not everyone who's disgruntled is going to come with a gun and shoot people. But what are the bullet points here that we should be looking at?
Well, if we were in the role, first of all, let's look from the employee standpoint. No one knows that your fellow employee better than you. You know good days and bad days. You know what's going on at their home life. If you come to work, you're going to share with what's going on. And we encourage employees that they start hearing things that are causing some concern to tell somebody they trust in human resources or another supervisor. You're going to also hear that the person is always disgruntled. I think we've always worked with somebody that just no matter what you do, you can't please them. And they're always disgruntled about something, from equipment to hours to policy. And they will have a tendency to really express that. Then the next thing I would probably remind people of is that they're great at externalizing blame. It's not my fault. It's somebody else's fault. And these are things that happen over a period of time. I like to tell people that people, when we watch the media and we hear what's happening, you'll always have somebody say, they just snapped. Well, guess what? People don't just snap. There is a time when they take some action, but snapping isn't it. This guy planned this. That's not a snapping activity. That is, as you're being an attorney, you know, there's some premeditation there just by the fact he has a gun there. These things are there for employees to be able to see and hear way before the employer does. And so they have to have a really good respect and dignity between employees to be able to share that.
From what I see, and you would know this better, Rex, but there it seems like there's more and more of these kinds of shootings in the workplace. So I'm going to ask you two questions in one, and that is, why are we seeing more of these kinds of shootings, number one, and number two, are there copycat issues here? Because it just seems so strange that we have certain dates seem to provoke people to do things like, you know, we have Waco and Columbine kind of happened around the same time, and Oklahoma City bombing, I think, within a couple of days. Then we have this February 14th at Northern Illinois, not too far away. In fact, one of the kids who was working there as an intern was an intern at Northern Illinois in DeKalb, not far away at all. And then we had Parkland also on the same day. So the day after that, we have this shooting. Yeah. Is there some idea that there's this date or copycat mentality?
I think there's several philosophies about that and theories, and I don't prescribe to any of them saying it's I can't see it being by accident, but I also know that a lot of these folks that are doing this, like the high school type, they're doing it for some recognition, and they know that if they do it on a particular time, they're going to get not only that recognition, it's going to build up further. So there's some calculations that go into it. I wouldn't go bet on it.
Okay.
Now, as far as copycats go, there are more copycats than we know, only because people take the path of least resistance when it comes to creativity. So if we tell people this is the way this person did it, and there's somebody sitting at home contemplating, God, I got to get back at these guys, they're going to say, oh, it worked for this person. It should work for me. So we'll see that. Law enforcement's really, unfortunately, we're not always prepared for workplace violence. People say, why didn't the police do more about XYZ person? Well, because we don't have firsthand knowledge. It really has to start internally. So if you were to hear somebody talk about anniversary dates, hear them talk about things coming up in the workplace, that's when you got to figure out, okay, this guy's planning. And then you've got a forecasted date.
Rex, I'm going to have to break here, but I want to thank you so much for joining us. Rex Osborne with More Than Talk LLC. If someone wanted to have you consult with their company or their church or their school, how would they get in touch with you?
It's real simple. We've made it easy for folks. You can just get a hold of me at rexosborn.com. So it's rexosborn.com. And we're in Illinois, like I said, quite a bit. We spend a lot of time in Bloomington area around Lexington and that area. So be glad to come up and visit you and help out anybody we can.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. Coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio.
You can put away your tissues, because here's the answer to your legal issues. 30 years experience in this town. Karen Conti wears the legal crown, and it's about to go down.
Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. This is the time when you can ask me legal questions, any legal questions you might have. You can text them too, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. I'm going to go to some text that were up for a while here. There was a texter who said that my estranged husband has narcissistic personality disorder. He has been in fights at work and has been fired from every job he's had based upon lies and behavior issues. He always gets a new job because he presents himself well. He is truly a scary person. And as you know, we talked about narcissistic personality disorders on the show quite a bit. And these kinds of people are very scary because she's right. They are very good at getting a job because they're charming and they say the right things and they're very intelligent. But the truth of the matter is they have a hard time getting along with anybody, including a boss, including somebody with authority. And they tend to get fired. And this woman, I texted her back and I said, listen, you know, you're estranged. It sounds like you're not divorced yet. But still, it's a very, if you think this guy is dangerous, he's going to be dangerous if you try to divorce him. And I'm not saying you shouldn't divorce him. I'm saying that you should be very, very careful, because even if you're estranged and even though your relationship is over and he acknowledges it, when you try to divorce this kind of personality, it can be very, very difficult. He can be perceiving this as something that is a rejection of him, and that narcissist does not like to be rejected and does not like to be criticized, does not like to be ostracized in any way, shape, or form. So I told her to be very careful, but very, very interesting. We've got some calls coming in. I'm going to try to get to all of you. One texter asked me what's going to happen with this national emergency and will the courts strike it down? And my answer is I don't know. I just don't know what the courts are going to do. But national emergencies are very, the president has a lot of discretion in declaring a national emergency. And in the past, presidents don't do it that often, or when they do, it's not big news. A national emergency, you know, in the past might have been some sort of weather problem or some sort of issue like terrorism was declared a national emergency. And the president then has great authority to use money, to use the military, to freeze bank accounts, to stop social media, to do all kinds of things that the president believes is in the best interest of the country. So it's good at times of true emergencies. And if the president wants to use it in a bad way or in a way that may not be an emergency, it could be used in the wrong fashion. And the problem is that we don't have a lot of precedent. And that's how the law gets decided. How has this happened before? Have the courts said to the president, no, you can't do this because it's not a national emergency? I'm not super familiar with all the constitutional cases in the past, but the one that kind of stands out is one that happened in the 1950s. And it was, I believe, Truman was president, and he stopped the steel strikes that were going on, saying that it was interfering with the ability of the Korean War to be fought and to be defended in the way that our country wanted to do it. And the court, the Supreme Court, in some way, shape, or form, said, no, it's not a national emergency. I don't know exactly how they said it, but they scrutinized the fact that he declared the national emergency and basically said, no, it's not, and reversed it. But national emergencies have been called by Abraham Lincoln. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus, which is a very important constitutional right during the Civil War. We look back and we say, for somebody as democratic minded as Abraham Lincoln was, that probably was a very extreme thing to do. And in the past, Roosevelt interned Japanese Americans during World War II, and that was declared a national emergency. So I don't know how it's going to turn out, but it will be interesting. Okay, let's go to the calls. Mary. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you? Hi, Mary. Hello, Mary. Is Mary there? Okay. I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to go. Is there another call, Ben? Should I go to two? Hi. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. Okay. Mary?
Line one.
Okay. Hi, Mary. Are you there? Okay. Nope. All right. Give us a call, 981-7200, or text to 981-7200. A little earlier, we had a texter ask me the question, if you hire a Social Security lawyer, what does that lawyer do to help you get your Social Security benefits? And I'm not quite sure exactly what the exact question is, but I'll tell you what I know. If you are disabled and you want to apply for Social Security disability, whether you have depression or whether you have an illness, a physical illness of some type that stops you from working in the field and in the capacity that you've been able to work, you can apply for Social Security. Many times you will apply and you will get denied. You should try to do that yourself. I generally tell people, apply yourself, fill out the forms, get the medical work together. But if you are denied that disability, then you will hire a lawyer to appeal that denial. And these lawyers, that's all they do. They take these cases and they know the medical terms and they get the medical records for you together. And they argue that your disability is something that qualifies under the law and that that your work is now interrupted and you can't do the work that you used to do. And they're largely successful at getting you your Social Security disability. And then they take a percentage of a certain number of years of your disability to pay for their legal fees. And if anyone needs a lawyer in that realm, I have somebody who's very, very good and I trust very, very much in that realm. So you can always give me a call at the office or email me and I can send you that referral. That's WGN at AskKarenConti.com. Should I try Mary again? Okay, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be taking more texts and more calls. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, and if you can't get a hold of me or you would like to talk privately or email me, my number at the office is 312-332-7800. You can leave a message on my private line, or better yet, email me your situation. It's at WGN at AskKarenConti.com, KarenConti. We'll be back in a minute. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. I'm taking your legal calls here. I'm going to try to get to all of you. 312-981-7200. And I'm going to talk to the elusive Mary. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Yay.
Hi.
Okay. What's your question, Mary?
Hi. Here's my question. The Aurora shooting talked about workplace violence and concerns at the workplace. And I work in an emergency department in a healthcare setting, and we are constantly threatened by people that we see with being killed, being shot, being hurt. And on one hand, we're told that it's a felony to threaten a healthcare worker. But on the other hand, if there's any extenuating circumstance, like the person is inebriated or intoxicated or seems to have a mental health or behavioral health issue, that nobody's going to pursue this. And I'm just curious where the law actually sits on that, because, to be honest, we're kindly discouraged to call in concerns regarding violence in certain patients.
Could you just give me an example? I think I know where you're headed, but someone comes in and they've been shot, and why are they threatening you? They're just angry at you for what reason?
Yeah. They haven't even been shot. Somebody comes in and they're brought in against their will because they've been threatening other people.
Oh,
or they're
okay.
Inebriated or okay. Intoxicated. And they don't want to stay. And because we're forced to take care of them, they then threaten to shoot us. And they become very aggressive and violent towards us.
You know,
and they threaten to hurt us. They threaten to shoot us. They threaten to kill us or hurt our families.
I'm curious, is there a procedure in place where you work, where you report this kind of thing and have an incident report? Because It just, you know, you're right. This is a very difficult area because when you deal with people who have mental illness, they don't always act appropriately. And when you deal with people who are inebriated or on drugs, are, you know, they're lashing out and saying all kinds of crazy things. But again, you have a right to be safe in your workplace. And when do you know if this person is actually going to make good on that threat? Is there some formal procedure in place to make a report?
We absolutely can make a report. But I have to tell you, a lot of times when we try to make it, it's not always well received. If the person is obviously under mental health concerns or if they're inebriated or intoxicated, it's kind of like, well, they're just kind of drunk or, you know, they're just a little off. So it's just, and again, on the other hand, we're told that it's a felony to actually threaten a healthcare worker.
Yeah, and that's just, it's a strange line because mm-hmm. that's what you're doing. This is what you do for a living. You deal with people who yeah. are lashing out and doing these kinds of things. You know, I don't know what the exact answer to that is, and I guess I would want to ask you some more questions about, are you mm-hmm. concerned that they will hurt you right there at that workplace, or later on they will come and find you and hurt you, or is it both?
I think it's both, and in fact, I think it's actually three A's. We're concerned about violence right at the point where it's being threatened. We're concerned about violence when we actually leave our workplace and somebody might be waiting for us. And we're concerned about violence if we were to make a report and then have our name on the record.
You know, I think this is something that you should deal with very, very directly with your HR people. And it would be hard for me to believe that hospitals do not have these kinds of programs in place, because what you're telling me is a real issue and a real threat. And there should be some kind of way to a formal procedure to manage this at the point in time and even later, because you don't want people to know your name. You don't obviously want people to know where you are, but in this day and age, people can Google you. And when people are hell-bent on hurting somebody, they can find you. And I think mm-hmm. this is something that you should deal with your HR people. That's my best advice, because there's no good answer where the law ends and your rights begin on this kind of thing. But thank you for bringing that to our attention, Mary. Take care.
No, thank you.
All right. Let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike. Welcome to WGN.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've had a couple 2 weeks ago, and we were talking about people in town, you know, small town talk, and they're saying that they can get any information they want because their son is a police officer, blah, blah, blah. And they know everything about everything. Now, that okay. I told them, I said, that sounds like privacy policy,
a violation of
me. I mean,
okay.
Yeah. So, and I said, you can't indulge information, and your son cannot indulge this information because he's a police officer. Am I right?
Yeah, you're right. As a practical matter, however, I do know that there are occasions when police officers can run searches for automobile information and for criminal history with the police department, and they do that
right.
kind of on the...
The Wisconsin police officer, I live in Illinois.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. What you're asking, well, is it wrong? It's wrong for a police officer to use private information that they get on the job outside
yeah,
of the realm
like
of their job.
It's about private people.
Yes. Again, the problem is him. He's threatening to do that, or there's talk that he's doing it, but you have to have proof that he did that. And until you do that, you're not going to go anywhere with that. But you're absolutely right. Police officers should not and are not supposed to take information that they get at their job and use it for their own personal use. That's absolutely correct.
Right.
And if you have evidence,
you know,
that that's the case.
Exactly. I mean, you know, they're supplying their mom and dad with the information around people around town.
Got it. Okay, Mike. Well, yeah, I think it's just something you're going to have to, you know, if you have proof, you can make that report. On the other hand, just so you know, as far as criminal records go, you can get a lot of information now from the courts and from private investigators, and we can run searches for criminal convictions. So it could be that this information comes from other sources. Again, do police officers violate that privacy? They do. Question for Karen from a texter. If most of our assets are in 401k, IRAs, and expected pension and Social Security, and we have less than $500,000 in home and car, is a $1 million umbrella insurance policy sufficient, or do we need to cover the full value of our retirement assets? Let me just use this opportunity to say what an umbrella policy is. If you don't know what that is, it's a policy that covers over and above what your home policy and your auto policy covers. So you have the same insurer for both of those, home and auto, and you get an umbrella, which means that when your limits run out, right, for your home and your limits run out for your car, then there's a next layer of coverage up to $1 million. Everyone should have an umbrella policy because when you get sued, it's very common, you know, let's just say that you ran somebody over, God forbid, in your car. You know, damages are going to be in excess of $200,000, right? So why not get more coverage? And it's not that expensive. And umbrella policies are simply not that expensive. And then I don't know what the difference is between $1 to $2 million, but you might want to call your insurance agents and say, well, what's the difference between the $1 million and $2 million? And if it's an extra few hundred dollars per year, I would definitely do that, because even though what you're saying here is that most of your assets are protected because they're retirement assets, and that even if you had a lawsuit against you, they probably couldn't get to that. Why take the chance? And why take the chance that any of your assets could be impacted? And again, you know, just being on the safe side, get that umbrella policy and get as high limits as you can and as high limits as you can afford. But I'm going to defer to the agents who know much better, you know, what the best thing is. I had a texter this week who, or an emailer this week who asked, along the lines of the Aurora shooting, was asking about the Aurora shooting and that whether or not the victims could possibly sue the police because there was a problem with his FOID card. Apparently, he went and got a FOID card. He was given the FOID card. He bought the gun. And then when he went to get the concealed carry, they ran his fingerprints and found that he was a felon and had some sort of aggravated battery charge and conviction in Mississippi. And he was supposed to turn in his weapon, but ended up not doing it. And no one knows if the police followed up or not. The answer to that is I don't think the victims would have a very strong lawsuit for the police, because the police are really protected for the most part from these kinds of lawsuits, unless you can prove that they were deliberately indifferent or they almost intentionally didn't do something. That's as simply as I can state it. As far as suing the employer, there may be a lawsuit and there probably will be lawsuits. And my guess is going to be that the employer, they're going to allege that the employer should have noticed that he had his conviction in Mississippi for a violent crime and that they should have never hired him. Or even when they knew they were going to terminate him, and they maybe they should have taken extra precautions knowing about his violent history. Again, he was working there for 15 years and maybe he had changed himself, but that's definitely going to be some lawsuit. I just know that is what's going to happen, and I'm sure that the employer has insurance for this type of thing, and we're going to see that down the line. Let's take a break now, and I'm going to take some more legal calls. 981-7200, 981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN.
She's legally blonde and brilliant. Karen Conti, attorney at law, is taking your legal questions right now. Call 312-981-7200. That's 312-981-7200. Breaking rocks in a hot sun. I'm on the
lawn. Now's your time to ask legal questions or questions about anything you saw in the news this week. If you have a question about it, give me a call here. I'd be happy to discuss it. 981-7200 or text to 981-7200. I had a texter, and I'm just going to paraphrase, was asking the question. I think the question was, because the snow is covering all of the lane markers, are you still legally obligated to stay within your lane? I think that was the question. And the answer is yes. The answer is yes. I mean, you are. If you go outside the lane, I don't know what police officer is going to pull you over in the middle of a snowstorm for going over on the other side of the lane. But you know, for, I guess, for instance, if you were to get in an accident and it was determined that you were on the other side, you kind of moved into the other lane and it was your fault, you're still basically obligated to stay within your lane, even though you can't see the lane markers. You know, that's probably my best answer. I never handled a case where that was the exact issue. But yes, you got to stay on your side. And you, I guess you have to have an imagination when the snow is on the ground. Let's go to the phones. We have Bill. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show. You have a legal question?
Oh, okay, thanks. On this case in Aurora, I got a question to ask. They said that some people said, well, of course, I guess the company didn't run background checks, I guess. But the guy went to get a conceal and carry, and they found out that he had a criminal record, was convicted, and spent time in jail in Mississippi.
Right.
Okay. Now, when they found that out, how did he even get a FOIA card to buy the card in the first place? Because anybody can go online and find if you got a felony conviction. Because I can go on the internet and put in anybody's name, and if you got a criminal record, it's there.
So here's
the thing I want to know is, once he was told with his fingerprint he couldn't get a concealed and carry because he had a conviction and was convicted and was in prison, then they send him a nice little letter and say, oh, since you are a felon, you must turn in all firearms. Could you bring them to us? Now, what kind of law is that? I mean, if you're caught selling drugs, they'll bust your door down to search for the drugs in your house or anywhere else. Well, then why didn't the police have the authority, if the authorities had the authority, if you're a convicted felon and they know you got a gun or you got a FOIA card that you had a gun, why can't they search your place for it or search you? I don't get that.
And, Bill, I'm with you on this. I am.
I mean, what's the loophole? Is that an NRA loophole?
Well, I don't know. But if there is a state police officer who could weigh in on what the procedure is, what is the narrow question that I have is, and this bill, I slightly may be different than what you said. My understanding is he got his FOIA card, but they didn't run prints for the FOIA card, although I thought they did that, but I guess they don't. But they didn't find his conviction when they gave him the FOIA card. He bought.
Well, where did they look? That's what I want to know.
I don't know.
If I can find this stuff on the internet, why can't the police or the authorities find
always,
the same thing?
It's not
thing?
Always that easy, because every state is not, there's not some database that for all states and all federal and everything else. It's not as easy as that. But I don't know how the government does it when it comes to guns, but apparently they didn't find it when he got his FOIA card. But when they did find it was when he went for concealed carry, because they took his fingerprints and his fingerprint came up and it attached to the Mississippi case. I agree with you. I would like to know, what is the procedure when the police know that someone has a gun and he has a felony conviction and he shouldn't have a gun? I'm with you, Bill. I think this should have been handled aggressively. And now, in hindsight, it's even more important. But what is the
procedure? My theory is, the guy that okayed for him to keep the gun and just send a nice letter, they should be held responsible and spend some prison time.
Well,
because they authorized him to have a gun.
Well, and it's,
I mean, it's the same thing if you're in a car, like this case, I forget where they got, east somewhere. This young kid, I forget, he was like 17, 18 years old. He was a lookout for some guy robbing something in New York City. I think it was over the weekend or last week, Monday. And he's convicted for murder because his partner shot the person in the store.
Right, felony murder.
And he can't understand. Well, I was just a lookout. Well, you're still involved in the crime.
And yeah, I'm going to put you on hold, Bill. I'm going to probably try to answer this question. I'd like to know what the loophole was to it, and it's probably something that there was a glitch. They sent the letter to him, he didn't respond, he didn't turn in his weapon, and there was no follow-up. I'd like to know what is the procedure in place for getting back a gun when someone has it wrongfully. That's a very narrow question, and I like that very narrow answer. If someone knows the answer, call me at 981-7200. Now, to sue someone or hold someone criminally responsible who's a police officer for not following up and getting the gun, that's, you're not going anywhere with that. I understand your anger, and I understand that you want to blame someone for that. But the government, suing the government is very difficult, because We go back to the day of the king. The king is always right. And so suing the government, you have to prove more than just negligence, right? It's not just negligent entrustment. If it were a parent who was negligent in allowing a child to have a gun, that's negligence. When it's the government, it almost has to be an intentional finding. And it's very, very hard. And to hold someone criminally responsible for that, who are you going to hold responsible? Which person? The whole state police department? So I get the anger. I get the problem. And my guess is there's going to be bills that are going to be proposed within the next week, whereby if there's a situation where someone is found to be a felon, that there's going to be an aggressive procedure, just like you said, where they go and they get a warrant and they go into the house and they get the gun back. And I agree with you that that should probably be the case, because if there was a mistake made and they gave this guy a gun and a right to carry the gun, they should have taken better action to do that. I agree with you on that. Let me go to Frank. Hi, Frank. Welcome to WGN. How are you?
Hi, Karen. I have a question. The city shut down my Uber account over some parking tickets that are not mine about a year ago. And I've since signed up with Lyft, and now they're threatening to shut down my Lyft account over the same tickets. Now, these tickets, they actually belong to my dad. We have the same name and address, but I haven't been able to drive Uber in a year, and now they're going to shut down my Lyft account over these tickets that are not mine.
Okay.
Is there any legal action I could take against them for doing that, for keeping me from earning an honest living driving Uber?
You know, I used to know more about parking tickets and how to deal with them, but things have changed drastically. My advice always when it comes to parking tickets is to go into wherever you need to go into, and I don't know where that place is. You're going to email me this week, and I will tell you where to go. I'll find out from a friend of mine who practices in this area. And you're going to go there, and you're going to go there with the tickets. You're going to go there with all the proof that you have that this is not your car, this is not you, that it's your father and not yourself. And you're going to talk to a human being, and you're going to work this out. You're going to pay what's yours, and you're not going to pay what's his. Or maybe,
right,
maybe you get your dad to go in there and pay his tickets so you don't have this problem, if you can do that.
That's kind of the thing. These tickets are about 20 years old. And I don't have a registration for the car. I don't have anything. It's hard. It would be hard for my old man to add in there. And
how much are we talking about?
We're talking like $400.
Okay. And again, you know, I say get a human being, face to face human being. And, you know, those people aren't—they're not really bad people to deal with. These are Chicago, right? This is Chicago.
Well, they're not very friendly either. I've talked to them on the phone many times, and I don't know.
The phone is not the place to do it. The way to do it is to do it in person if you can. So let me do this. I'm going to give you, Frank, I'm going to give you my email address at the office, and I'm going to try to get you the place to go to get this taken care of. WGN@AskKarenConti.com. It's KarenConti. We're going to take some more of your legal calls. 981-7200. The phone lines are open. I'm going to get to all of you. So we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with some more legal questions on WGN. Back. We're in the home stretch here. 981-7200. I'm going to try to get to all of you. Scott has an interesting question. I probably don't have an answer to it, but I would like to hear it anyway. Scott, welcome to the show.
Yes. If I have a question, I don't know if it's a legal question, but I'm at Union Station quite often, and during a service interruption, the station itself and the trains get really crowded. So my question is there a maximum capacity for Union Station? Is there a maximum capacity for the trains themselves? And is this legal when this happens? There's got to be, you know, you go to the theater, there's a maximum capacity, or a restaurant, maximum capacity.
So is the problem that you're crowded in Union Station or on the platform or on the train?
All three, actually. When there's a service disruption, people keep coming into Union Station itself. Then when they get on the train, I mean, there's standing room only, and so, I mean, literally, the station and the trains themselves get completely crowded until the service disruption, you know, somehow dissipates.
Interesting. Did you Google, in fact, the capacity of Union Station? Because I have never heard that issue. I mean, I always assume that, you know, Union Station and the Metro, you know, these are, they just accommodate as many people that go through there. And how would they monitor it? I mean, I wonder how they could say no one can go into Metro because there's too many people in here. Being on a train platform seems to me to be a different story, because that could entail a lot of danger, that people could fall on the tracks and the like, and certainly on the trains there would be a capacity limitation.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's an interesting question, and I'm going to ask, I have a client who actually works for one of the trains, and I'm going to ask, mm-hmm. I'm going to ask him if there's anything like that. I've never heard that. I didn't know that was an issue, but apparently Ben, my producer, said that you're right, when with all the disruptions that we've been having with weather and the like, just really, and do you feel that it's dangerous?
Extremely dangerous. I mean, you know, when you're on the train and you can't move, let's just arbitrarily say that there's a someone has a medical emergency on the train. If they're in the middle of the train and the conductor isn't nowhere to be found, which, because they can't move through the train, so what, you know what I mean? That definitely sets up a possibility for an emergency situation.
Well, and not to mention, right, you know, just people stepping on each other and falling on the tracks.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you know,
absolutely.
What? Let me look into that, and let me ask some questions, and hopefully I will be able to answer that on my next show. Thanks, Scott.
That would be great.
Thank you. An interesting question. Let's go to, I think it's Jake. Hi, Jake. Welcome to WGN.
Hello. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question. I had looked for place, and I didn't get my last two paychecks. It's roughly like $2,500. And the problem was, we didn't clock in at a certain place, so we clocked in on our phones. And I've gotten logged out and never clocked in, so there's really no record. So I'm looking to like go outside the guy's business and basically like protest, I guess, hold a little sign. And I'm just wondering what I can and can't have on that sign, and where I can and can't be, I guess.
Okay, let me just, have you tried going through the Illinois Department of Labor?
No.
Okay, why don't you try this first? Because the last thing you want to do is get sued or arrested. And I'm not saying you're going to be, but you want your money, okay? And the most direct way to get your money is to do the following. There is the Illinois Department of Labor Wage Claim Division. You go there, you can do it online now, you fill out the forms, you say what your pay was and what the agreement was, what hours you worked and what you weren't paid for. Now, at this point, he's going to say, he meaning your boss, is going to say, well, we don't have any proof that he actually worked. Is there any witness, is there any coworker that could say that, yes, in fact, you did work that day? Is there?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And is there any documentation? Like, do you ever fill out forms at work or whatever you do? Is there something that would prove that you were actually there at the workplace?
Not really. It'd pretty much just be just a guy that worked with. No actual documentation.
Okay. Well, and that doesn't mean you lose necessarily. So you put that all together and you submit it to them. What's good about this is you don't need a lawyer and it's free. And the Department of Labor, they're not the quickest, but they will investigate it. They will ask for the employer to give their, you know, their side of the story. And then they will make a finding as to whether or not you are owed that money. And employers don't like to go through this because sometimes there are fines and attorney's fees and things like that. So hopefully, by filing this, hopefully you'll be able to get your paycheck. Now, as far as going out and protesting, you just have to be really concerned because you don't want to be arrested. You have a right to be in a public place. You don't have a right to be on their premises if they don't want you to be. And if you say something that's factually false and damaging, you could be sued for defamation. I don't know that an employer is going to go sue you for doing that, but my guess is that we're not really worried about a lawsuit. We're worried about you getting arrested, because that's what they're going to do. They're going to try to take care of it by having the police come and take you away. I just don't know if that's worth it. Do you really think that it was an effective way of getting your paycheck?
Oh, probably not. I mean, I kind of just want to, I don't know.
I guess going through the labor board is probably the best option.
Yeah,
I appreciate
it. Yeah, why don't you do that? It's really user friendly, and they do a pretty good job of getting your paycheck. And like I said, they're motivated to get rid of it because they don't want anyone looking into their records because they could go back and find people who weren't paid, and that's a problem. But good luck to you. All right.
All right.
Take care, Jake. Yeah, you know, and even people who put reviews on Yelp and you feel angry because you've been wronged by a restaurant or something, you know, you just have to be careful because you don't want to be sued. And if it's important for you to tell people something about an employer or a place where you ate or whatever it is, I mean, that's good. I think that's important. I think if you feel strongly enough about it, but take a deep breath, maybe wait 24 hours before you do something like that, because is it really worth getting sued? And some companies now are suing and because their businesses can be ruined by a couple bad reviews. And there are people who are serial bad reviewers who just spend their whole day writing bad reviews to get back at somebody for something. And, you know, is that worth it? Is it worth it to get sued? And my answer is going to probably be no. I had a caller this week who wanted to know, I was talking a little bit about the Jason Van Dyke prison beating, and I'm not going to really go there because we talked a lot about that this week. But the issue is, do prisoners win these lawsuits that they bring? They seem to bring a lot of lawsuits for things that happened in prison that are minor. And do they, in fact, win these lawsuits? And the answer is no. Prisoners, a lot of prisoners bring these lawsuits on their own. They don't get lawyers. And when they do it, they sue over minor things. And it's kind of like a hobby for prisoners. And they do have a right to bring the lawsuits. And the courts have to hear them. And the courts regularly dismiss them or have findings that they're not, they don't have merit. But prisoners do bring them. Now, there are more serious lawsuits that prisoners bring when they do get beaten up. In fact, one of the cases that Chicagoans might remember was the Brown's Chicken murder. And as we remember that crime, two people were convicted. I believe their names were Luna and Degorski. And Mr. Degorski was in prison and was beaten up, I believe, by one of the sheriffs, or he was in some sort of fight in the prison. And it was found that the prison didn't do what it needed to do, and it violated his constitutional rights. And he went to a jury trial and got a $480,000 verdict. I mean, this is a guy who's in jail forever. I don't know how many people actually were killed at Brown's Chicken. Was it six or seven? I don't recall. But he's a convicted murderer, and he got $480,000 from a jury for personal injuries relating to him being in prison. That's very unusual, and most lawyers don't like taking these cases just because when you go before a jury, the jurors don't like to give money to people who are convicted of crimes. They just don't, and it's very hard to prove that the prison could have stopped something from happening when, in fact, prisons are very, very, very unsafe places. I mean, you can't protect people from just about everything. So the Jason Van Dyke case, I don't know how badly hurt he was, but the issue is, you know, he is owed, he has to be protected. And the fact that he's a police officer who was convicted in a very high profile national case where he might have a target on his back, the prison really has to take extra steps to keep him safe. Whether you like what he did or not, whether you agree that prisoners should be safe, that's what the law is and that's what the Constitution says. But thank you for listening tonight. I hope you don't get snowed in, and I hope that your commute tomorrow is not too bad. But anyway, I'm going to give out my numbers in case you want to call me with legal questions or email me. The best way to do it is email me, because then I can send you something back, maybe a referral to a lawyer or an agency or something that can answer your question. And that's WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Or if you'd like to call, it's 312-332-7800. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN.